The following year, Pauler and Fest sent along praise through the intermediary of a former student who looked up Fermi in Rome. A 3-month fellowship then took the young Italian to Leiden for the traditional Ehrenfest tightening. After that, Fermi could be sure of his worth. He was always averse to philosophical physics. A rigorous simplicity and insistence on concreteness became the hallmark of his style. Segret thought him inclined toward concrete questions verifiable by direct experiment. Wigner noticed that Fermi disliked complicated theories and avoided them as much as possible. Bethe remarked Fermi's enlightening simplicity. Less generously, the sharp-tongued Pauli called him a quantum engineer. Victor Weisskopf, though an admirer, saw some truth in Pauli's canard, a difference in style from more philosophical originals like Bohr. Not a philosopher, Robert Oppenheimer once sketched him. Passion for clarity. He was simply unable to let things be foggy. Since they always are, this kept him pretty active. An American physicist who worked with the middle-aged Fermi thought him cold and clear, maybe a little ruthless in the way he would go directly to the facts in deciding any question, tending to disdain or ignore the vague laws of human nature. Fermi's passion for clarity was also a passion to quantify. He seems to have attempted to quantify everything within reach, as if he was only comfortable when phenomena and relationships could be classified or numbered. Fermi's thumb was his always-ready yardstick, Laura Fermi writes. By placing it near his left eye and closing his right, he would measure the distance of a range of mountains, the height of a tree, even the speed at which a bird was flying. His love of classification was inborn, Laura Fermi concludes, and I have heard him arrange people according to their height, looks, wealth, or even sex appeal. Fermi was born in Rome on September 29, 1901, into a family that had successfully made the transition during the 19th century from peasant agriculture in the Po Valley to career civil service with the Italian National Railroad. His father was a capo divisione in the railroad's administration, a civil rank that corresponded to the military rank of brigadier general. In accord with the common Italian practice of the day, the infant Enrico was sent to live in the country with a wet nurse. So was his brother Giulio, but because Enrico's health was delicate, he did not return to his mother and father until he was 2.5 years old. Confronted then with a roomful of strangers purporting to be his family and, perhaps, writes Laura Fermi, missing the rough effusiveness of his nurse, he began to cry. His mother talked to him in a firm voice and asked him to stop at once. In this home, naughty boys were not tolerated. Immediately the child complied, dried his tears, and fussed no longer. Then, as in later childhood, he assumed the attitude that there is no point in fighting authority. If they wanted him to behave that way, all right, he would. It was easier to go along with them than against. In 1926, when he was 25 years old, Fermi was chosen under the Italian system of concorsos, national competitions, to become professor of theoretical physics at the University of Rome. An influential patron had seen to the creation of the new post, a Sicilian named Orso Mario Corbino, a short, dark, volatile man, 46 when Fermi sought him out in 1921, the director of the University Physics Institute, an exceptional physicist and a senator of the kingdom. Since the old guard of Italian physicists resented Fermi's rapid promotion, he especially welcomed the protection of Corbino's patronage. Corbino found support for his efforts to improve Italian physics from the fascist government of the bullet-headed former journalist Benito Mussolini, although the senator was not himself a party member. In the later 1920s, Corbino and his young professor agreed that the time was ripe for the small group they were assembling in Rome to colonize new territory on the frontier of physics. They chose as their territory the atomic nucleus, then finding description in quantum mechanics but not yet experimentally disassembled. Fermi's tall, erudite Pisa classmate Franco Rossetti signed on as Corbino's first assistant early in 1927. Rossetti and Fermi together recruited Segret, who had been studying engineering, by taking him along to the Como conference and explaining the achievements of the assembled luminaries to him. By then, Segret saw, Pauli and Heisenberg recognized Fermi's talents and included him among their friends. The son of the prosperous owner of a paper mill, Segret contributed elegance to the group as well as brains. Corbino added Eduardo Amaldi, the son of a mathematics professor at the University of Padua, by frankly raiding the engineering school. The group quickly nicknamed Fermi the Pope for his quantum infallibility. Corbino, like Rutherford at the Cavendish, called them all his boys. Rossetti departed to Caltech, Segrais to Amsterdam, for seasoning. Fermi sent them out again in the early 1930s, after the decision to go into nuclear physics. Segrais to work with Otto Stern in Hamburg, Amaldi to Leipzig to the laboratory of the physical chemist Peter Debye, Rossetti to Lisa Meitner at the KWI. By 1933, with a departmental budget above $2,000 a year, 10 times the budget of most Italian physics departments, with a well-made cloud chamber and a nearby radium source and KWI training in the vagaries of Geiger counters, the group was ready to begin. In the meantime, 2 months after the Solvay conference, Fermi completed the major theoretical work of his life, a fundamental paper on beta decay. Beta decay, the creation and expulsion by the nucleus of high-energy electrons in the course of radioactive change, had needed a detailed quantitative theory, and Fermi supplied it entire. He introduced a new type of force, the weak interaction, completing the 4 basic forces known in nature: gravity and electromagnetism, which operate at long range, and the strong force, and Fermi's weak force, which operate within nuclear dimensions. He introduced a new fundamental constant, now called the Fermi constant, determining it from existing experimental data. A fantastic paper, Victor Weisskopf later praised it, a monument to Fermi's intuition. In London, the editor of Nature rejected it on the grounds that it was too remote from physical reality, which Fermi found irritating but amusing. He published it instead in the little-known weekly journal of the Italian Research Council, Ricerca Scientifica, where Amaldi's wife Ginestra worked, and later in the Zeitschrift für Physik. With only minor adjustments, Fermi's theory of beta decay continues to be definitive. The Compte Rendu, reporting the Joliot-Curie's discovery of artificial radioactivity, reached Rome shortly after Fermi returned from skiing in the Alps in January 1934. "We had not yet found any nuclear physics problems to work on," Amaldi reminisces. "Then came out the paper of Joliot, and Fermi immediately started to look for the radioactivity." Like Szilard, Fermi saw the advantages of using neutrons. I.I. Rabi catalogues those advantages in a lecture. "Since the neutron carries no charge, there is no strong electrical repulsion to prevent its entry into nuclei. In fact, the forces of attraction which hold nuclei together may pull the neutron into the nucleus. When a neutron enters a nucleus, the effects are about as catastrophic as if the moon struck the Earth. The nucleus is violently shaken up by the blow, especially if the collision results in the capture of the neutron. A large increase in energy occurs and must be dissipated, and this may happen in a variety of ways, all of them interesting." When Fermi began his neutron bombardment experiments, he was 33 years old, short, muscular, dark, with thick black hair, a narrow nose, and surprisingly gray-blue eyes. His voice was deep, and he grinned easily. Marriage to the petitely beautiful Laura Capone, the daughter of a Jewish officer in the Italian Navy, had encouraged him in methodical habits. He worked for several hours privately at home, arrived at the Physics Institute at 9, worked until 12:30, lunched at home, returned to the Institute at 4, and continued work until 8 in the evening, returning home then for dinner. With marriage, she had also gained weight. He and his team of young colleagues occupied the south section of the second floor of the Institute, sharing the space with Corbino and with the chief physicist of Rome's Sanità Pubblica, its health department, a generous soul named G.C. Trabacchi, who lent Corbino's boys some of the instruments and supplies they needed for their experiments. In return, they cherished him, nicknaming him Divine Providence. Antonino Losordo, a frustrated old guard physicist, fended off the encroaching horde from an office at the north end of the floor. Corbino and his family lived above, the residence overlooking a private garden in back with a goldfish pond at its focus. The first floor served students, the basement held electrical generators, and a lead-lined safe for the Sanita's gram of radium worth 670,000 lire, about $34,000, in that year of its most historic use. Glass pipes passed through a wall of the special safe to carry radon, formed in the decay of radium, to a compact extraction plant, a modest refinery of glass pipe towers that purified and dried the radioactive gas. The residential upper story of the Institute, contracted above the longer lower floors to make room at one end for the dome of a small rotunda, was roofed with tile. The location of the building in a small park on a hill near the central part of Rome was convenient and beautiful at the same time, Segrais recalls. The garden, landscaped with palm trees and bamboo thickets, with its prevailing silence, except at dusk when gatherings of sparrows populated the greenery, made the Institute a most peaceful and attractive center of study. A gravel path that shone white in the golden Roman sun led down to the Via Panisperna. As usual, Fermi hewed the neutron experiments by hand. In February and early March, he personally assembled crude Geiger counters from aluminum cylinders acquired by cutting the bottoms off tubes of medicinal tablets. Wired, filled with gas, their ends sealed and leads attached, the counters were slightly smaller than rolls of breath mints and 100 times less efficient than modern commercial units, but with Fermi to operate them, they served. While he built Geiger counters, he asked Rossetti to prepare a neutron source in the form of polonium evaporated onto beryllium. Since polonium emits relatively low-energy alpha particles, the resulting source emitted relatively few neutrons per second, and Fermi and Rossetti irradiated several samples without success. At that point, Rossetti, showing a surprising lack of eagerness for historic experiment, went off to Morocco for Easter vacation. Fermi cast about for some way to acquire a stronger neutron source. The rationale for using polonium in the first place, in Paris and Cambridge and Berlin as well as in Rome, had been that a stronger alpha emitter like radon also emitted strong beta and gamma radiation, which disturbed the instruments and interfered with measurements. Fermi realized suddenly that since he was trying to observe a delayed effect, he was measuring only after he removed the neutron source in any case, and therefore any beta and gamma radiation wouldn't matter, and he could use radon. Trabacchi had the radon to spare and willingly dispensed it. With a half-life of only 3.82 days, it was perishable in any case, and his glowing gram of radium continually exhaled a fresh draft. To the basement of the Physics Institute on the Via Panisperna, in his gray lab coat in mid-March, Fermi thus carried a snippet of glass tubing no larger than the first joint of his little finger. It was flame-sealed at one end and partly filled with powdered beryllium. He set the sealed end of this capsule into a container of liquid air. The radon, directed from the outlet of the extraction plant into the capsule, condensed on its walls in the minus 200 degrees centigrade cold. Fermi then had to attempt quickly to heat and draw closed the other end of the capsule without cracking the glass before the radon evaporated and escaped. When he succeeded, he finished preparing the neutron source by dropping it into a 2-foot length of glass tubing of larger diameter and sealing it into the far end so that it could be handled at a distance safe from dangerous exposure to its gamma rays. For all the tedious preparation, its useful life was brief. In the beginning, Fermi worked alone. He intended eventually to irradiate most of the elements in the periodic table, and he started methodically with the lightest. His source, he calculated, supplied him with more than 100,000 neutrons per second. Small cylindrical containers filled with the substances tested, he would explain in his first report, were subjected to the action of the radiation from this source during intervals of time varying from several minutes to several hours. Fermi first irradiated water, testing hydrogen and oxygen at the same time, then lithium, beryllium, boron, and carbon, without inducing them to radioactivity. Laura Fermi says he wavered then, discouraged by the lack of results. But Fermi seldom talked shop at home, and doubt seems unlikely. He knew from the Joliot-Curie work that aluminum, a little farther along, reacted with alphas, and neutrons should prove even more effective. In any case, he succeeded on his next attempt, with fluorine. Calcium fluoride, irradiated for a few minutes and rapidly brought into the vicinity of the counter, causes in the first few moments an increase of pulses. The effect decreases rapidly, reaching the half value in about 10 seconds. Soon he found a radioactivity in aluminum with a half-life of 12 minutes, different from the Joliot-Curie's discovery. putting aluminum first to link his work with theirs, he reported his findings in a letter to the Ricerca Scientifica on March 25, 1934. A Roman numeral 1 distinguishes that first report on radioactivity induced by neutron bombardment. The search was on. To move it along, Fermi recruited Amaldi and Segre and cabled Rossetti in Morocco to rush home. Segre writes, "We organized our activities this way. Fermi would do a good part of the experiments and calculations. Amaldi would take care of what we would now call the electronics, and I would secure the substances to be irradiated, the sources, etc. Now, of course, this division of labor was by no means rigid, and we all participated in all phases of the work, but we had a certain division of responsibility along these lines, and we proceeded at great speed. We needed all the help we could get, and we even enlisted the help of a younger brother of one of the students, probably 12 years old, persuading him that it was most interesting and important that he should prepare some neat paper cylinders in which we could irradiate our stuff." The next letter that went to the Ricerca Scientifica, and in summary form to Nature, reported artificially induced radioactivity in iron, silicon, phosphorus, chlorine, vanadium, copper, arsenic, silver, tellurium, iodine, chromium, barium, sodium, magnesium, titanium, zinc, selenium, antimony, bromine, and lanthanum. By then they had established a routine. They irradiated substances at one end of the second floor and tested them under the Geiger counters at the other end, down a long hall. That shielded the counters from stray radiation from the neutron source. But it also meant, whenever the half-life of an induced radioactivity was short, that someone had to run down the hall. Amaldi and Fermi prided themselves on being the fastest runners, Laura Fermi notes, and theirs was the task of speeding short-lived substances from one end of the corridor to the other. They always raced, and Enrico claims that he could run faster than Eduardo. But he is not a good loser. A dignified Spaniard showed up one day to confer with His Excellency Fermi, Rome's young professor of theoretical physics, a dirty lab coat flying out behind him, nearly knocked the visitor down. They came, finally, to uranium. They had roughly classified the effects they were seeing. Light elements generally transmuted to lighter elements by ejecting either a proton or an alpha particle. But the electrical barrier around the nucleus works against exits as well as entrances, and that barrier increases in strength with increasing atomic number. So heavy elements got heavier, not lighter. They captured the bombarding neutron, threw off its binding energy by emitting gamma radiation, and thus, with the addition of the neutron's mass, but with no added or subtracted charge, became a heavier isotope of themselves, which then decayed by the delayed emission of a negative beta ray to an element with one more unit of atomic number. Uranium did the same. After a delay, it emitted a beta electron. That should mean, Fermi realized, that bombarding uranium with neutrons was producing first a heavier isotope, uranium-239, and then a new man-made transuranic element, atomic number 93, something never seen on Earth before. It was necessary to purify their uranium sample, uranium nitrate in solution, a light yellow liquid, of the obscuring beta activity its natural decay products gave off. Uranium decays naturally through a series of 14 complex steps down the periodic table to thorium, protactinium, radium, radon, polonium, and bismuth to lead. Trabacchi, in his generosity, had by then even lent the group a young chemist, Oscar D'Agostino, fresh from training in radiochemistry on the Rue Pierre Curie. D'Agostino accomplished the laborious purification in early May. They were using stronger sources now, up to 800 millicuries of radon, about a million neutrons per second. Irradiating the uranium nitrate gave a very intense effect with several periods of half-lives. One period of about 1 minute, another of 13 minutes, besides longer periods not yet exactly determined. Thus their May 10th report. These several induced radioactivities were all beta emitters. They made whatever atom was emitting them heavier by one atomic number. It seemed to follow, then, that they were transmutations up the periodic table into the uncharted new region of man-made elements. To confirm that stunning possibility, Fermi needed to demonstrate with chemical separations that the neutron bombardment was not unaccountably creating elements lighter than uranium. The one-minute half-life was too short to work with, so he concentrated on the 13-minute substance. D'Agostino diluted the irradiated uranium nitrate with 50% nitric acid, dissolved into the acid a small amount of manganese salt, and set the solution to boil. By adding sodium chlorate to the boiling solution, he precipitated crystals of manganese dioxide. When he filtered the crystals from the solution, the radioactivity went with the manganese, much as the radioactivity the Joliot-Curies had induced in aluminum went off with the hydrogen gas. If the radioactivity could be precipitated out of the uranium solution along with the manganese carrier, then it must not be uranium anymore. By adding other carriers and precipitating other compounds, D'Agostino proved that the 13-minute substance was neither protactinium, 91, thorium, 90, actinium, 89, radium, 88, bismuth, 83, nor lead, 82. Its behavior excluded elements 87, then known as ecassesium, and 86, radon. Element 85 was unknown. Perhaps because the half-lives were different, Fermi made no attempt to check polonium, 84. But he felt he had been sufficiently thorough. This negative evidence about the identity of the 13-minute activity from a large number of heavy elements, he reported cautiously in Nature in June, suggests the possibility that the atomic number of the element may be greater than 92. Corbino injudiciously announced a new element at the annual convocation, the King of Italy in attendance, that closed the academic year, which set the press baying and gave Fermi a few sleepless nights. Having so splendidly accomplished Szilard's rather boring task, the weary physicist was happy to depart after that with his wife and their small daughter Nella for a summer lecture tour sponsored by the Italian government through Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil. Leo Szilard had emerged from his bath that spring of 1934 to pursue his favorite causes, not yet joined, of releasing the energy of the nucleus and of saving the world. In a late April memorandum condemning the recent Japanese occupation of Manchuria, he seemed to look ahead to a far future. "The discoveries of scientists," he wrote, "have given weapons to mankind which may destroy our present civilization if we do not succeed in avoiding further wars." He probably meant military aircraft, the horrors of strategic bombing and even its potential for deterrence through a balance of terror were much bruited at mid-decade. But almost certainly he was also thinking of atomic bombs. Several weeks earlier, looking for a patron, he had sent Sir Hugo Hearst, the founder of the British General Electric Company, a copy of the first chapter of The World Set Free. "Of course," he wrote Sir Hugo with a touch of bitterness, still brooding on Rutherford's prediction, "all this is moonshine, but I have reason to believe that, insofar as the industrial applications of the present discoveries in physics are concerned, the forecast of the writers may prove to be more accurate than the forecast of the scientists. The physicists have conclusive arguments as to why we cannot create at present new sources of energy for industrial purposes. I am not so sure whether they do not miss the point." That Szilard saw beyond energy for industrial purposes to the possibility of weapons of war is evident in his next patent amendments, dated June 28th and July 4th, 1934. Previously, he had described the transmutation of chemical elements. Now he added, "the liberation of nuclear energy for power production and other purposes through nuclear transmutation." He proposed for the first time a chain reaction in which particles which carry no positive charge and the mass of which is approximately equal to the proton mass or a multiple thereof, that is, neutrons, form the links of the chain. He described the essential features of what came to be known as a critical mass, the volume of a chain-reacting substance necessary to make the chain reaction self-sustaining. He saw that the critical mass could be reduced by surrounding a sphere of chain-reacting substance with some cheap, heavy material, for instance lead, that would reflect neutrons back into the sphere, the basic concept for what came to be known, by analogy with the mud tamped into drill holes to confine conventional explosives, as tamper. And he understood what would happen if he assembled a critical mass, spelling out the results simply on the fourth page of his application. "If the thickness is larger than the critical value, I can produce an explosion."